Good morning, Marbleites, and good morning, everybody out in live stream land. You know it is cold here in New York. I don't know where you are, but I hope that you're in your jammies with your nice fuzzy slippers on and a nice hot cup of coffee or maybe hot cocoa, something. We are here, and although nobody is in jammies here, but a number of us have a nice cup of hot coffee. Today, we're going to be talking about the year of the Jubilee, it's so cool. You remember last week, we talked about Ruth and Naomi, and remember that they were far from home. Naomi is far from home. Ruth and Orpah, the two widows of Naomi's children, sons, are... They're Moabites, and we're in the land of Moab, which is not the land of Israel. And, why are we there? Why is Naomi there? Remember that Naomi is also a widow. Her husband was Elimelech, which means God owns everything. God is king. Why were they in Moab and not in Israel? Well, the year of the Jubilee might give us a clue about why that would be. We are, if you've got a Bible, go ahead and get it. If you don't, we got some around the corner. If you're at home, get that Bible that your aunt gave you when you were confirmed and unzip it and open it up this way so that it'll open a little bit. And, you know, it's time to go back to that. In Leviticus, the book of Leviticus, which is right after Genesis, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. In the 25th chapter, we hear about two things. The Sabbath year, and I'm in the beginning of chapter 25. First it says, the Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, and then he gives him a whole lot of rules that he's supposed to do about a Sabbath year. It's important for us to know that... These writers are writing a long time after the Lord spoke to Moses on Sinai. But they take their laws and they put them backwards into Moses' mouth in a way that we would say, oh, well, that's not very honest, is it? But that's not how they thought. What they're saying is these laws are important. These laws are God's will. Moses gave us the law, so we're gonna take this back to Moses. And it's not dishonest if you kind of know where they're coming from. It's just not quite the way we would do things. So we hear in the first verse of the 25th chapter of Leviticus that Moses said these things, and we can probably assume that he probably didn't, that this went onward in time, and now we're really in a place sometime much later. But in any case, what the law is, you have to give the land a Sabbath. Speak to the people of Israel. And say to them, when you enter the land that I'm giving you, the land shall observe a Sabbath for the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you should prune your vineyard and gather in their yield. But in the seventh year, there should be a Sabbath of complete rest for the land. You know that the Sabbath for a person and for a household is enjoined in the book of Genesis. The Sabbath is the last thing to be created in the 7 days. And some might say that because it comes last after the creation of human beings, that it's the most important, that the Sabbath is kind of the queen of creation. Not only should people have a Sabbath, the land needs a Sabbath. Now this is, you know, because we know about this now. Ecologically, it's so important not to drain your land dry. And they, of course, don't have any of the fertilizers and things with which we are currently poisoning the earth and increasing huge yields. They've got slash-and-burn agriculture. They have composting, such as organic farmers use today, which is really the best way to treat your land. And so the Sabbath of the land is a holy duty, but it's also a practical duty. It gives the land a chance to rest. You're not going to reap the aftergrowth of your harvest, that which comes up after you've done everything down. It's going to be a complete rest. You may eat what the land yields during its Sabbath. And the animals and everybody participates in this. Well, so what do you do in that year? I mean, what do you eat if you can't? If you're a farmer and all you have to eat is what you have, then how do you eat? Well, God says he's gonna increase. He's gonna triple the yield in the sixth year, so you'll be fine. And I sure hope he did that, because if he didn't, that could be a problem. So the Sabbath year, it mirrors the creation of the Sabbath in Genesis. It certainly echoes the need for human beings to have a rest and to refresh themselves, which is a sophisticated approach that sort of puts us to shame, because we've lost the ability to rest. Many of us here, a lot of people here, remember when you couldn't get anything, right, on a Sunday. All the stores were closed. And if you didn't have it on a Friday, on a Saturday night, you weren't going to get it until Monday morning. And we all survived that. If you're Jewish, it was the same. If you didn't get it by sundown on Friday, you just were going to do without it until Sunday. Good when Jews and Christians lived together, because some store was going to be open for sure to somebody. Somebody was going to be able to eat. And you know that it was customary in New York for Jewish families to hire a Christian kid to come and turn lights on and off, because turning lights on and off is work, and you're not supposed to work, but you can have your little neighbor come in and do it. And so he would do that. Not only is there a Sabbath of years, there's a Sabbath every 50 years, and that's the Jubilee. It's 50 years in the Bible, and to us still, the word Jubilee means, it's related to 50 years. We talk about a Jubilee of our 50th anniversary, or the Queen's 50th Jubilee, and now her 75th Jubilee. Good Lord, the woman will never die. So we have that kind of a Sabbath, too. What happens during the Jubilee year? Let's take a look. It's seven weeks of years. So it's like seven times seven. So it's every 49 years. And then the 50th year is the year of the Jubilee. You started on the Day of Atonement, which we talked about. The trumpet sounds and the Jubilee begins. It's a year of liberty throughout the land. You shall return, every one of you, to your property and every one of you to your family. You shall not sow or reap the aftergrowth, so it's a land Sabbath as well. When you make a sale of land in Israel, you're really not selling it. We don't sell land in Israel because we don't own land in Israel. God owns land. But we sort of loan it. We sort of lend it to people. It's like a lease. And so no lease in ancient Israel is going to go longer than 49 years, because after that, it reverts to its former owner. So, think about that for a minute. How about if you buy something in year 47? That's real different from if you buy something in the first year. Again, we look at things, we think, this would be chaos. How would you ever have an economic system that would work? And it wouldn't make sense for us, because we live here. But there it did, because the indebtedness that a lot of people had was to the crown, the king representing God, representing Israel. And in this time, the political king and the king of kings are kind of one. The king is also a religious functionary. A lot of the debt people had is to him. And then there's debt to each other when you buy and sell something else. So this would look to us like, a bailout. And today when we talk about bailouts, we view that as very negative. And we view it as what economists call a moral hazard. that you don't want to encourage people not to pay their debts. And here we're looking at this Jubilee. You buy something, and then if you wait until the year of the Jubilee, all your debts are canceled. If you sell somebody into slavery, say you have to sell yourself into slavery. Well, no Israelite can enslave another Israelite. That's not allowed. Oh, you can enslave foreigners all you want. But you cannot enslave another Israelite. If you sort of sell yourself to another Israelite, again, you have not sold yourself. You've leased yourself. And he cannot treat you as a slave. He has to treat you as a hired servant. And it may be that you're not going to get any money for that because you're doing this so that you can pay your debt to him. But you're not like a slave, like somebody who is caught in war or like someone from the outside. The big difference for them between insiders and outsiders. Big difference for them between Israelites and not Israelites. So if you do that, you get to return home. You get to be redeemed in the year of the Jubilee. Maybe a relative of yours can redeem you earlier. So you get into trouble, and so you sell yourself, lease yourself to some richer person. And what he has is he has the use of your land, the use of your labor. You get poor, and so you work your land, but he gets to keep the produce, and you get to stay alive, and that's good. In a more serious situation, maybe you can't get your way back. The hope is in this tenant farmer situation, you'll make enough money that you can kind of redeem yourself and go back to the way you were. But maybe you can't. Maybe your debt is worse. Then you've got to give all the land to your debtor, not just your labor, but the land. But even if you have to do that, it's not going to be for longer than 49 years. Now, that's a long time in ancient times. We don't live to be very old. That's two generations even for us. So, but it's not forever. And again, we think, well, wait a minute, that just can't be right. You know, I might just be an idiot with money, and you're going to reward me at the end by giving me back everything I did not earn. That's the way we think about it. But for them, they're more thinking about stability. What are we going to do with families that don't have a livelihood? Where are they going to be? They're going to be in the street. We don't want that. Where am I going to get my soldiers, says the king, from families who don't have places to raise children and take care of them? I need a lot of soldiers. And in order to have a lot of soldiers, and they needed a lot of soldiers because they were always at war with somebody, they needed people to stay on their land and to be productive, and there needed to be a way back if they weren't productive or if they just fell on hard times. Naomi and Elimelech must have been one of those people. They had no other way to take care of themselves, so they went into a foreign country thinking, well, maybe we can find a way there, or maybe we can sell ourselves there. And their sons married girls from there, which later was an issue for them. And that's probably what happened to them. In the third stage, so first you have a problem, and then you can kind of earn your way back. Second stage, you have a problem and you can't earn your way back, but later on, you get your way back because the Jubilee comes and you're forgiven. In the third, he's got to work him as a slave. But in the end, nobody can own him. They can't own each other. So the year of Jubilee for us in ancient Israel is a time of release and freedom and celebration and a recognition that, yes, life is hard and you may not do well and it may be your fault or it may not be your fault, but in the end, whether it's your fault or not, it's not going to matter because we are more interested in keeping society stable than we are in assigning fault. That would not be the case today, would it? But there are some survivals of that. For instance, bankruptcy laws. Your bankruptcy in modern culture, it may be your fault or it may not be your fault, but bankruptcy does not worry about fault. Bankruptcy is kind of like no-fault divorce. It's not about whose fault is this. It's just about what kind of a deal can we make so that a creditor can get so many cents on the dollar and you're going to be able to, and you can, I think, keep your house. Maybe you can keep your car. I don't know. But there are rules about bankruptcy that are really not about whose fault it was. And it's an old custom. And while when we think that somebody has been bankrupt and this sure doesn't look good to us, and indeed it is a blot on his record for a certain number of years, at the end of those years, it's not anymore. It sort of goes away. It may not go away from the press. Press might be talking about the fact that you were bankrupt three times for the rest of your administration. But it goes away legally. And many people use it without a sense of shame. I think a lot of us approach it feeling that it would be a great shame to do that. But many people do it and don't feel, or at least are not regarded legally as guilty in some way because they've done it. There's a law to cover it, and so they're covered. So that's a way in which we sort of have an opportunity for a jubilee. The jubilee law, every 50 years, was a way of evening out the playing field again, balancing the scale again, giving everybody, whether they deserved it or not, a second chance. And I'm wondering what we think about that deserved it or not part. Because, you know, we're not ancient Israelites. We are Christians. One of the things we think is that while we were yet in our sins, Christ came to redeem us. We call Christ the Redeemer. We call him a lot of things, but the Redeemer is one of them. And the Redeemer in the Old Testament is that relative who might come and pay your debts for you. That Boaz was the redeemer of Ruth. She was the widow of a kinsman of his. She is destitute. Somebody has to redeem her. Boaz did. So he was her redeemer. When we use the term redeemer, we really only use it with regard to Jesus. And we understand that redemption does not come as a result of our merit at all. So Jesus himself is like the year of the Jubilee. What do we think about this idea of redemption unrelated to virtue or innocence? Here comes the microphone. Is anybody prepared to come out against it? Here comes somebody, but we don't know.
Isn't that how all those parables work about the workers that show up at 5 a.m. and the ones that show up at 5 p.m.?
Right. Remember that one?
Isn't that how heaven works?
Yeah.
You know, as humans, we want everybody to be smited immediately for the slightest injustice, and God says,
I'm not going to do that. Remember that? That's the story about the three bunch of guys that work, and some go early, and then some go in the middle of the day, and some go late. And so the guys who go early think, well, yeah, I'll do better. And they don't. And they're angry. And then the audience that Jesus is telling this to, they would certainly say, well, that's not right. But maybe they would feel that way if it's the year of the Jubilee or close to it, or if they are used to the idea of the Jubilee, they are not completely unacquainted with the idea that your forgiveness, your redemption, that God's favor is not all about whether you're good or not. And we often think, well, you know, the Old Testament is the God of vengeance and stuff, and the New Testament is a God of love. The Jubilee is a loving doctrine. It's a loving teaching. And we've talked about this before. So is purgatory. It doesn't sound like it, it's not a thing that we talk much. Anybody talks much about today. But in historical times, it was a sort of a mitigating factor between salvation and damnation. Salvation, you're good. Damnation, you're in big trouble. But you have this sort of way out. Purgatory, You can serve however many hundreds of thousands of years, you got to do it. And if you buy some art for the church, oh, you know, we wouldn't have any of the treasures we have if it weren't for purgatory. I'm in favor of it. But, so that's kind of like the Old Testament year of the Jubilee. I am not familiar with anybody, and I have not carefully studied this, I've not been aware of anybody studying purgatory who has linked it to Jubilee. But it feels like that to me. It is a mitigating doctrine in between something much harsher. You know, the Jubilee in ancient Israel wasn't the only example of get out of jail free teaching. We have it in other lands. For instance, there were sometimes when a king would come, a new king would come, one of the things he would do would be cancel all debts. And when a new president comes, one of the things he does is tries to give some good stuff to certain people. So he kind of wants to celebrate his accession with some pork. In ancient times, Hammurabi, in ancient Babylonia, in Assyria, and in Egypt, a new king would proclaim a clean slate sometimes, or would celebrate something by just removing all debts, to sort of going to wipe it clean. You're going to be all right. We're just going to start again. You know the Rosetta Stone with the three languages on it? That was actually a clean slate proclamation. It was a cancellation of debts in the reign of Ptolemy V in Egypt. I did not know that. I just tripped over that while I was researching. So the idea of wiping out debts isn't new with Israel, but that it's going to happen every 50 years is, that you're going to have a sort of a set time in which the usual rules don't apply. 6 days when you have to work and then a seventh when you don't. 6 years when you harvest normally and then a seventh when you let the land rest. 49 years when you take care of business as you usually do, and then 1 year when all the slate is wiped clean. So there is a mechanism within, certainly within our culture and a few in other ancient cultures, but systematized in our Judeo-Christian culture that in a way that's, I like it. I think it's nice. It gives you a way out. In our country, we had debtors' prisons in the very early years of our foundation, and do not now, and the bankruptcy laws that we just spoke about are one way that we don't have that. It was a way to eliminate a system which, in addition to punishing the debtor, deprived him of any opportunity to get back. How are you going to earn money to pay your debts if you're in jail? You can't. You can't make any money in jail. So you just get in deeper and deeper in debt to society and to whoever you owe money without any way out. So it isn't just our culture, our Christian culture, that has ways out for us, that has ways around our own sinfulness, our own stupidity, our own mistakes. We acknowledge that, you know, we're going to make them, and there's going to be a way for us to get back to where we are. What do we think about that? Who has a response about getting out of jail free? Ours is a punitive culture. We're very interested in punishment, aren't we? People really want those who do the wrong things to suffer.
You know, we all have some level of sin, right?
That got something.
And, you know, how many times are we speeding and don't get caught?
Yeah.
You know, so it's not balanced. And who am I to say anything when I know I speed and sometimes I don't get caught?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what I have to say about that.
Yeah.
The other point that I think is interesting is this, the notion of planning that must have been prevalent at the time. You have to plan for the seventh day.
Yeah.
You have to plan for that seventh year. And I wonder, given our society of everything being available anytime,
now, yeah.
Are we losing that notion
of planning?
Do
we even know how to do that anymore?
Yeah.
Do you know? I mean, you know, it certainly was true of an older generation, anybody who lived through the Depression. Even if you were a child then, not responsible for your family, but you knew what hardship was. It was just in the air. And so you never depended on, oh, this is going to be fine forever. No, it's not, because you just knew that things weren't always fine. And we, I wonder about us. You know, we certainly wonder about ourselves. How do we respond to hard times, and how do we prepare for them? We don't have a healthy habit of saving money in our culture. Some other places do. There are countries in which you don't, you know, you go to Greece and you see a lot of houses that aren't finished, tons of them. That isn't just because their economy's in trouble. You always see that in Greece. It's because you don't borrow to build a house. You build it. In Greece, cars cost a whole lot. Houses less, because you don't borrow to buy them, whereas we really don't think of houses except in terms of debt and reward debt as it regards to housing with tax deductions for mortgages. You may remember, if you paid taxes a while back, that there was a time when you could deduct credit card debt. Those were the days, right? But, and, you know, not now. So what that tells us is that there is a fear that you probably ought to have of not planning ahead. And it may be that might attach itself to mortgage debt too, which would make our society very different and our attitude toward owning a home, which we now call the American dream, as if all we thought about were money. You know, and that might change. That might change under this. Yes, sir.
I was just thinking that Michael had given a sermon once about forgiveness. And he said that at the end of the sermon, when he was greeting people leaving, most of the people said it's easier for them to forgive other people than forgive themselves.
Yeah.
And they all had trouble forgiving themselves.
Yeah, easier to forgive other people than to forgive yourselves. The universal perpetrator is me for the things that I have done, and I might be able to get past you, but I can't get past myself sometimes. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Well, it occurs to me that when we have churches and we have certain schools, that they can run up debt, and somewhere along the way we came up with this deduction that we can take so that we can forgive poorly managed churches or poorly managed schools. And those among us who can do something about it with a contribution, mm-hmm. we've gotten that we can deduct that, mm-hmm. but that gives us some encouragement to help that .org or that charity mm-hmm. to persist.
Yeah. So, you know, these economic things are not far from spiritual things. When someone tells you, oh, you know, the church should never talk about politics. Well, kind of has to. I think the church, the Bible does, and we talk about the Bible, so I think that it's not far away. That's kind of different from some church saying who you should vote for, but to talk about moral issues, surely politics is, among other things, the expression of moral consensus, or at least the attempt to reach some kind of moral consensus. So, and money and debt is about that. It's about the way people live. It's about how you manage your affairs. And the every man for himself approach that mostly we take, well, if you fail, it's your own damn fault, and I'm not going to bother you. I'm not going to help you. That's not very biblical. You know, the people often say, well, you know, it says in the Bible, the Lord helps those who help themselves. You know what? Doesn't say that. It just pretty much says the Lord helps those who need help. And when we, you know, the people are packing for Ecclesia upstairs, packing up sandwiches and stuff to do the church service that they're going to have today down in the park for people who don't have a place to be. And they don't ask when they give the sandwich, well, now, why are you homeless? Why are you poor? Why are you hungry? Did you bring this on yourself? No sandwich. No, you just don't do that. The Lord helps those who need help. And in generosity and forgiveness, the very meaning of forgiveness is that you don't judge. You know, if you didn't do anything wrong, I don't have to forgive you. You're fine, right? You don't forgive people who didn't do stuff wrong. You forgive people who did. So we're not talking about the innocent when we talk about forgiveness. We're only talking about the guilty. And so this helps us not worry about having to sort through things and judge whether so-and-so is better than so-and-so. Never mind. Let's just be free and be free in ourselves and be free to love and leave it at that. And let God do the judging. At the end of the Civil War, there was a large number of people who were suddenly free. Their descendants still celebrate Juneteenth, which was the day of that freedom, which arrived kind of in advance of the reality of that freedom for many of them, and certainly way in advance of the reality of equality for any of them. But it remained an important, and remains an important holiday, and it is related specifically to the year of the Jubilee. The year of the Jubilee was spoken about in speeches at that time, spoken about by Frederick Douglass, spoken about, sung about in songs, and is remembered by Dr. King in a very, very important speech that he gave. It was exactly, seems to me, a year before he was killed. And it was here, not at Marble, but it was at Riverside Church. And in it, he was already the famous Dr. King that we knew. He was already the one who had done so much to combat racism directly and without violence, and he would have been the first to say, had not finished the job, but he had done so much to continue that work that even today we revere nobody as much as we do him with regard to this work. And so he was already had this reputation, and he already had also the reputation among people who didn't like it, that this was a guy that we really need to get rid of, and a year later they did. But he came to Riverside Church, and while he was there, he had made his reputation on the struggle for African Americans to be included in the citizenry in an equal way, for us to be one country, black and white. And that's, when you talked about Dr. King, that's what you were talking about. He goes to Riverside a year before he is killed. It's April 4th, 1967. He's killed on April 4th, 1968. And he gives a speech in which he doesn't just talk about, let us into your society, let us into this country. We live here, let us in. It was more about questioning some basic things about that society. It wasn't just, please let us in, let us be equal to you. It was, wait a minute. We are equal to you, but there are some things we have to fix. Here's what he said. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. Now, when he said that, that's more serious than let us in. That's more serious than, oh, let us please be equal. It is, we all have something of which we must cure ourselves. We have a problem as a society, and the problem isn't only that you won't let us in. It is that the things that we are basing our common life on now need to change. And when, you know, when we look, and how long ago is this? 50 years ago. 50 years ago this year was that speech given. He talks about a thing-oriented society versus a person-oriented society. And we look at ourselves today. We are so thing-oriented, so materialistic. He talks about the militarism and, you know, our military budget is so huge and you're not allowed to complain about it. And certainly racism. And, you know, maybe today we would add sexism, because that was not as much in his mind and other people's minds then as it is now. But certainly it's the same kind of sin. So we look at a prophet like that and we remember that, yes, Rhonda.
Could you reread the quote again?
Again, his quote is Dr. King at Riverside Church on April 4th, 1967. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. It's prophetic words and dangerous words to some people. Because a lot of people, I remember back then, and you probably do too, that a lot of people called him a communist. And a lot of people did that. And we were, we were still, the Soviet Union was then what it was before 1989. And so that was quite an accusation to make of somebody. And a speech like this, in which he denounced the thing-oriented culture that we have. He talks about the computers and look at how we have come to relate to the whole world of computer technology today. I mean, he didn't know the half of it.
No.
and my goodness. And it's true that we just think today that buying things is going to help us be happy and holy, and that prosperity is a sign of God's favor. Well, it isn't always. There's many people who work a lot harder than I do and are dirt poor. So it was a prophetic thing for him to say. And he echoes the prophets of the Old Testament. It's Amos, he says, you have made the ephod great, the small, and the shekel great. The ephod is a unit of volume, like you have going to have an ephod of grain, and the shekel great. So you have, this is inflation. You have made the ephod small, I can't buy much, and the shekel great, but it's going to cost me a lot of money. It's going to cost me more than it used to cost. Also, Amos, you're going to, you know, you take a calf and slaughter a calf. Well, so what's wrong with that? It's veal. No, you don't do that to a calf. Why? Because the calf needs to grow up, give milk for many years, have babies, produce in a lot of ways. If you kill the calf, you're also killing the potential that calf has to be a productive part of the world. So you don't kill a calf. You don't eat veal. You wait, and then, you know, when it's older than dirt, you slaughter it, and then you have to stew it because it's so tough you can't eat it. But it has paid its dues to this world, and you have used it wisely and well. So they're very interested in economics in the Old Testament and in politics in the Old Testament, and they don't separate politics from spirituality the way we tend to. When we talk about the separation of church and state, we don't really mean that you shouldn't talk about politics in church. We just mean that the government shouldn't tell you what church to belong to. And that's true. We sure don't want that to happen. But it isn't that politics should have nothing to do with religion. That can't be the case. Did I see a hand over here? Yes, madam.
I am coming.
Uh-oh, wait for the mic. Here she comes.
Oh, I just wanted to, before we leave, to go back to the Juneteenth situation.
Tell us.
Well, it's a young celebration for the African American, because it really is about when those who did not know that they were free...
Got the word.
And I taught Black history in 1978 across the country for a government program. I knew nothing about Juneteenth.
About Juneteenth?
No. And I went to all Black schools, all Black teachers, even my second grade teacher was a cousin to Booker T. Washington. So
really?
I was steeped in Black history.
Oh, my goodness.
But never knew about it until just a few years ago. I have a good friend from Texas. They did not know that they were free. And so they were celebrating it, and I went to the celebration, and I said, why are we doing this? And she explained it to me. We didn't, you know, in our area, we didn't
Didn't it
know.
Start in the West, in Texas, that the word did not get to them? And
they
in fact,
didn't, know.
Didn't
in
they
Texas.
Didn't they delay telling them for one more
well,
harvest?
For some reason, perhaps
Just
they
let
did.
You get one more cotton harvest in, and then we'll tell you you're free.
So I just wanted to kind of, you know, let those know who don't know, because I did not know, never heard
How
of
many
it.
Has not heard of Juneteenth?
I had my child actually has said that that should be a national holiday. She should get the day off and we should have a party.
That's right. Right.
Something that has been leaping out at me because I didn't know where it occurred. In the very first verse where it talks about the year of the Jubilee, we have the phrase, well, not in my translation, but in the King James, it's proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all the inhabitants thereof. That's on our Liberty Bell.
It is, yeah. Very conscious of the Jubilee.
Had something simple to add about like the plague of minorities and I guess society as a whole. And I think that it's got to do with the family unit and how the values are passed down and pretty much the, I can speak for the minority, I guess, because, you know, and that the values are, and men are not taught, per se, what it is that it is to be a man. Mm-hmm. So then all these other values that are out there in the world are picked up, and then somehow people think that, hey, if I do this, I'm going to be whatever the label you want to put on whatever it is. But I think that that's a big, big problem within that there is, let's say, no how-to book, per se, okay, you're a man, and this is your you know what you need to pass down as far as values and everything else, because then values are placed in the wrong way, materially and emotional and whatever. So I think that's that I wanted to put pretty much. And I personally have taken an interest to as to like my family tree and whatever and what it was and where it came from, because in essence, like, if you don't know per se like your history and where you came from, then you're lost. You don't have per se self-value, meaning, okay, this is how I'm supposed to behave. This is what I'm supposed to do. This is what I'm supposed to look like and all those things.
And for these writers, this idea was integral. You can't have rootless people who don't know where they're supposed to be and don't have a place to be, because if you have that, you have chaos, and they sure don't want that. The Jubilee... Your deals, even if you get the wrong end of the stick, it's not permanent. There will be jubilation at the end. There will be justice in the end. There will be rejoicing at the end, because things belong to God. They don't belong to us. And since everything belongs to God, let's sing a song. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole wide world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands.
got the little bitty baby in his hands. He's got the little bitty baby in his hands. He's got the little bitty baby in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. We're running out of time. He's got you and me, brother, in his hands. He's got you and me, sister, in his hand. He's got you and me, brother, in his hand. He's got the whole world in his hands. Thank you, folks.